I'd like to thank the Pacific Center for Technology and Culture, and of course, in particular, Arthur and Mary Louise Croker for inviting me to speak here today. It's great to be here on such a lovely day. Sun's shining, rabbits are here.
It's all good.
The paper that I'm going to present today is forthcoming in the Canadian Journal of Communication, and it's co-authored with three wonderful graduate students at the University of British Columbia, Lori McIntosh, Sherilyn Jordan, and Huilin Lin. And so I'd like to acknowledge their contribution to this work also. This is the first time that I've presented this paper, and so I'm really looking forward to getting your feedback. Mass media accounts about the significance of the internet to queer folks in communities commonly foreground celebratory and apparently uncomplicated narratives. These mythologies routinely feature members of marginalized communities who find a place online to form communal networks, feel a hard-won sense of belonging, or at least locate relevant and appropriate informational resources. A recent Time magazine cover story on gay teens, for example, unproblematically recounts that when University of Pittsburgh freshman Aaron Arnold decided to reveal his homosexuality, he just Googled coming out, which led to myriad advice pages. What might it mean to think about the significance of Google in the complicated arena within which is situated the culturally and historically contingent spectacle of coming out? What does Google know that Aaron Arnold doesn't? Who does Google think that Aaron Arnold is? Google's promise is built on the potent lure of publicness, visibility, and identification, produced and regulated technologically. However, there's nothing straightforward or necessarily salutary about the relationship of subaltern sexual identifications, intelligibility, and human-machine assemblages. In the 1960s, for example, the RCMP implemented a project known as the Fruit Machine, designed to make visible and in so doing to eliminate queers from the civil service. A complex machinery was assembled, including a range of questionnaires and surveys, as well as the assessment of variations in pupillary response by subjects viewing images of naked men and women. They had a camera mounted on pulleys, and it was put in front of you and you watched images projected on the wall. In a spectacular display of techno power, the state apparatus marshaled considerable technological resources in order generatively to produce visibility and in so doing to effect its repressive aims. Queer theory complicates an analysis of technology as other, power as immanent, outside, or monolithic, and of identification as either insidious or innocent. Queer theoretical accounts of acts in contexts of categorical identification lean heavily on Foucault's problematization of an economy of visibility. Genealogical methods of analytical critique excavate and push to center stage a cultural matrix of power knowledge relationalities. Access to minoritarian subjectivity is coextensive with the reiteration and incorporation of prescriptive norms. Post-structuralist arguments concerning queer subjectivity likewise make extensive use of Judith Butler's influential work on performativity. Butler asseverates that discourse materializes its effects and circumscribes the domain of intelligibility. In such denaturalizing, dramaturgical accounts of identity and sociality, seeking to be recognized as belonging to a particular identitarian group or community, is then more adequately to be understood as a complex cultural mise-en-scène that proceeds by means of a set of contingent performative practices. To be subjected, then, is to always already be imbricated within the discursive economy upon which the very constitution of that subject or community depends. Discourses concerning the potentially Democratizing significance of the internet as a cultural technology highlight mobility, play, and possibilities for a redistribution of rights of recognition, communality, and knowledge in a significant public sphere. A discursive logic of mobilization and heterogeneity likewise organizes discussions of queer. Thus construed, we could say that queer is always already virtual. Several key thematic preoccupations crisscross scholarship concerning queer and technoculture, including an intense focus on the cultural politics, power relations, and radically contingent and discursively mediated operations and practices of space, mobility, sociality, consumption, citizenship, and subjectivity. There is not yet a significant body of research on queer women and new media, and this project addresses that gap. Overwhelmingly, the scant research conducted to date has proceeded by means of critical exegetic analyses of online discourse. So people go to a site like Superdike or gay.com and they analyze the postings that people make. Discursive analyses of online postings indicate that access to narrow bandwidth sites coded as lesbian, for example, such as email lists or chat rooms, while providing an important location of relative safety, also seems to engender hyperbolic performances of identity that result in exclusion to the extent that homogeneity of identification is a condition of participation. So Nina Wakeford, for example, asks, it's not are you lesbian, but are you lesbian enough to succeed in these locations? Insights into everyday uses of media is a critical aporia produced by an analytic emphasis on media textualities. Accordingly, I follow a line of thinking from cultural media studies scholars who emphasize that research needs to eschew technological determinism or an effects of media model and carefully consider quotidian uses of popular culture. Open-ended, in-depth interviews concerning artifacts, identifications, and communities were conducted with 63 participants. This methodological choice was primarily motivated by a desire to address the absence in existing research of queer women's accounts concerning the situatedness of media in the context of everyday life. Interviews took place in multiple locations in British Columbia and Alberta. My interpretive frame for thinking about interview data is informed by Gail Mason's landmark study of homophobia, gender, and violence. Mason proposes a genealogical approach where interviews provide access to interpretive repertoires that index fields of knowledge by means of which practices of subjectification are mediated. As Lisa Lowe argues, quote, forms of individual and collective narratives are not merely representations disconnected from real political life, nor are these expressions transparent records of histories of struggle. Rather, these forms, life histories, oral histories, histories of community, literature, are crucial media that connect subjects to social relations. It's important to acknowledge here irremediable complexities pertinent to the methodology of interviewing. I take it as axiomatic that a research interview is enacted in a location of uneven power relations, runs the risk of reducing meaning to that which can be narrativized, and is circumscribed by the limits of language and the problematic of reinscribing the very discourses of subjectification that it seeks to trouble. My use of interview data today and in the article is somewhat unorthodox. Some people would say not even somewhat. It eschews ethnographic exegesis and proceeds by means of a juxtaposition of theoretical deliberations and interview excerpts. This is not a summative or a descriptive account. Roland Barthes, in his discussion of the subversive function of the still image in the cinematic work of Eisenstein, writes of the importance of the deliberative cultivation of obtuse over obvious meanings. It's so comforting when you find these passages and you think, ah, yes, thank you. pushing intelligibility, as Haver puts it so eloquently, to the brink of invention. This strategy also signals my methodological alignment with post-positivist research that troubles modernist readings of interviews as transparently representational and unproblematically accessible to the techniques of hermeneutics. There are many important and obvious themes that this particular reading does not attend to, including specificities pertinent to geographic location, age, continuities and discontinuities between embodied and online community, complexities implicated in the production of gender in ostensibly same-sex communities, and a whole lot more. Narratives concerning identificatory practices can be read as awkward tryouts for particular parts in a series of dramaturgical stagings, including reaching out for specific props, costumes, and scripts, juxtaposed against culturally normative accounts of the mediated self as other. As Clifford notes, quote, "Since the project of identity, whether individual or collective, is rooted in desires and aspirations that cannot be fulfilled, identity movements are open-ended, productive, and fraught with ambivalence." It was relatively common for participants to describe daily practices of living as highly mediated by a range of internet technologies and spaces, and their lives as relatively insulated from any cybercultural effects or affects. This may seem paradoxical. However, Mazzarella argues that the cultural politics of globalization, inside and outside the academy, involve a contradictory relation to mediation, on the one hand, foregrounding the mediated quality of our lives, and on the other hand, strenuously disavowing it. Many of the people we interviewed are imbricated in exactly this kind of intense suturing and simultaneous disavowal with media. Participants' descriptions of their varied engagements in the construction and presentation of queer identifications feature mediatic spaces and practices, including internet communities and locations, books, television, movies, and so on. And so the answer is clearly yes. SpongeBob SquarePants will make you gay. Sam, I had this thing that I secretly called Project 9. I would collect any sort of, like literally any instance of lesbian or mostly lesbian interaction. My parents had an editing suite, and I would edit them onto these tapes. If there was a lesbian kiss, I would cut out a lesbian kiss, even if it was framed around something kind of really negative. Characters that I suspected were gay, like Rosie O'Donnell before she was gay, like when she was on the Arsenio Hall show, for instance, I have that clip. Even Madison, the stupid lesbian subplot. I edited out everything else other than the lesbian subplot and produced a story. When the incredibly true adventures of two girls in love, like those narratives came out that were explicitly lesbian, and I was like, wow, because I was like, you know, reading The Unlit Lamp, Radcliffe Hall. Participants' accounts of self-making do not necessarily or inevitably prioritize same-sex sexuality, but rather entail a series of refusals of specific articulations of gender, racialization, sexual desire, age, and the like, and concomitantly the taking up, often provisionally, of available non-normative identifications. Participants' narratives of identification are complex and discontinuous accounts in which subjectivities are produced as moving projects, both prospective and retrospective, going somewhere and all the while weighted down by the baggage of a particular history and rootedness in a specific trajectory of locations and chronology. Shame. I was watching Ally McBeal and they had a scene where Ally and Ling Wu kiss, and I played that scene over and over again because I recorded it. I was kind of turned on, I guess. Yeah, and then after that, after I just went on the internet and looked up articles about am I gay, that type of thing. What did you find? Not very much at that time, but all my friends were straight, like all my friends at that time. There was a posting for a gathering on blurf.com, which is a Hong Kong-based website. And it was at a coffee shop in Vancouver. So I went there and met other people. The website wasn't local, but the posting was. I don't think my friends would just go to a meeting other Chinese women like my straight friends. It was just for queers in particular. And was that the first time you'd been in a room with a whole lot of other queer Asian women? Yes. A significant subset of the participants blog. As artifacts in the digital landscape, blogs are spaces of liminality where articulations of self and perceptions of community collide. The lines of so-called public and private no longer manifest, and users no longer inscribed according to this set of oppositions. The personal journaling format is a space where the self is carefully and painstakingly constructed and consumed. Julie Rack convincingly summarizes the unfulfilled promise of the virtual modernist project in her analysis of queer blogging culture. While these personal journal-style blogs move beyond the written diary as a point of translation from which to circulate articulations of self in a community of seemingly like others, they also reproduce and perpetuate a politics of normativity. Blogging, as a self-productive act, is driven by desire and is both a means and an end to the production of the self as whatever. For example, when speaking of her blogging male alter ego, Maleficent notes that he's really kind of pretentious and philosophical, because it's a persona, and like with my regular profile, the boy is only part of who I am. So this writing might be found in my normal blog, but this is only one aspect of my personality, and all my personality is found in my blog. Well, maybe not all of it, but just different aspects of it. So this one is just like if I put it through a filter. Right, your boy filter? Yeah. Catherine Hales maintains that the body exists in a dynamic flux between flesh and machine in a series of post-human articulations. In keeping with Hales' claim of the post-human space of the body, we want to argue further that within the threshold of the virtual, the body and the public-private trappings of identity come to be most clearly disarticulated, and that this ataxic subjectivity carries its own liberatory potential. Irrespective of age and location, interviewees continue to identify an ongoing relationship, both to the closet and pervasive and persistent impacts of homophobia. Narratives of sexual subjectivity testify to the cost of the economy of visibility, within which being recognizable as queer is both necessary and also constitutive of a mark of difference that is a target for violence in its myriad incarnations. Alongside Eve Sedgwick's powerful articulation of the epistemic structures that are produced and sustained by homophobia, it is axiomatic that what Anne Svetkovich describes as insidious trauma structures the quotidian experiences of those whose queer lives are produced as repudiated subjectivities. As Svetkovich observes, trauma becomes the hinge between systemic structures of exploitation and oppression and the felt experience of them. Jeanette, I was living on my own, so it didn't matter to me if my family never talked to me again. But Leslie was still living at home, and I didn't want to, you know, ruin her relationship with her parents. We've been together for 6 years now and lived together for 5 of those 6 years, and I don't know why we can't just be open about it, and if you don't like it, you don't like it. But small town Alberta is not necessarily fruit friendly. The one that I've been talking to identifies as a fruit. No. Leslie, there have been lots of suspicions, and I think once or twice I tried to speak of it, but it didn't go over very well. So, well, I tried to tell my mom, and she basically told me that I could never see Jeanette again. Cultural studies scholarship on queer migration and mobility underscores critical relationships between dislocation and specific articulations of sexual identification and community formation. Sexuality is indeed on the move, Michael Warner argues. Quote, not just because people are more on the move now than ever, but because non-normative sexualities so generally seem out of place and are so often enabled by the displacement of culture. The complex imbrication of constitutive processes of crafting a performative self, which is to say, a public self, situated in relation both to others and to spatiality, within the web of psychic and material violences that Goffman referred to as stigma and the management of spoiled identity, and Eribon as the shock of insult, seems intimately implicated in the production of finely tuned practices of mobility and reconnaissance. Queer invocations of dialectical tropes of home as sites of both familiarity and estrangement, attachment and loss, are complexly related to mobility and belonging. My interest in media practices, then, leads me to consider the figurative, tropic significance of homing devices as a necessary and fruitful correlative analytic construct in exploring how it is that homing desires are negotiated and remediated within and against the limits of spatialized queer imaginaries and varied sociocultural topographies. Participants' movement towards sites of connection was mediated by a wide range of homing devices, including gaydar, internet knowledge searches, email lists, and other quasi-objects. Efforts to hook up and or to locate and belong to communities of like others or target others are prominent features in our research interviews. Lee, I started using online stuff when I moved up north to Fort Nelson. There's not much gay community. I started to look online for community. I needed some sort of connection. I found a Yahoo group called BC Dykes. They were going out and meeting down in the Lower Mainland for coffees and for movies, and there was a real sense of caring. They tried to include those of us that were outside. They were going to have their first ever gathering on Spinster Vale on the island. And so I said, okay, I'm leaving. I'll see you guys. And I hit the highway, and when I got there, people had already posted, and there was a little log of my travels all the way down. So here I was, completely isolated, and I suddenly had a community of queer women. It really did save my ass. Kumi. I was on the internet, searching for my bisexual thing. I'd come across some, like, bisexual, lesbian, bicurious website, and I started talking to one of the other bisexual women in Edmonton, and we decided, well, we should meet for coffee. And I met her, and through her I discovered that there's a bi women's group. Accounts of participation in community are frequently marked by a relation of unbelonging, and therefore of desires that propel further mobility. Our invocation here of unbelonging signals the complexities of contemporary notions of relationality that involve dialectical rather than binary logics of location and related implication in affective topographies. As Smethurst observes, unbelonging is not itself a stable condition in the postmodern. While postmodern space and place become fluid, shadowy, and mutable, identity, which attempts to map such spaces, is conditioned by dislocation and dispersed belonging. Alice. The community in Edmonton, from my perspective, was really closed and really tied to a particular look and a particular setting, which I can sort of understand for visibility and recognizability. The younger women my age, anyway, were kind of like this baby butch, short hair and bleached and looking like a skater. They had no place for someone who wore lipstick and didn't want to cut her hair. I went to gay bars and that sort of thing, but I got hostile attitude, and it was clear that people didn't think that I belonged there. The internet facilitated those discussions, and those discussions couldn't have happened without these kinds of forums. All of a sudden, I was meeting all these people who were not fitting into that and who were like, no, femme can mean a variety of things. this is what it means to me, this is how it works with a lot of things, a lot of other parts of my identity. So yeah, it was really important for me, being not strictly identified as a dyke or a lesbian. So yeah, in Edmonton in particular, that was kind of my saving grace. Participants described the internet as an important source of knowledge, cultural engagement, and what Warner refers to as counterpublics, only where it was possible, by means of blogging or participation in a focused online community or email list, to identify a relatively bounded social network made up of similar others, Asian queer women living with mental health issues, leather dykes, and so on. Community-appropriate health and legal knowledge are ubiquitously very difficult for participants to locate online, irrespective of access to sophisticated public knowledge sites like university databases. While within the virtual demarcations of their acknowledged social networks, few white participants chose to identify or to discuss racism as a problematic aspect of community. Conversely, for Aboriginal, Asian, and African Canadian participants, the intersectional discursive construction of identifications, offline and online, explicitly organized and regulated the self-presentation of participants, whose experiences included, but were not importantly limited to, marginalization, silencing and enforced segregation, as well as engagement in resistance and the construction of counterpublics. Momo. Most websites look to me very race neutral. They don't have specific Asian content. It looks neutral, but it's mostly for Caucasians. Whenever I go to any so-called queer or gay events, I hardly find any Asian queers. There might be some. I feel there's a boundary there, although I'm part of that space, but I'm not. At a book reading, there was an Asian queer writer, and I volunteered that night. I just walked around and thought, okay, if I'm not going to see any Asian people, I'm just going to leave. She, the writer, said that when she looked around the whole space that there were no Asians, and so when she saw me walk inside the room, she said she felt like there was a special energy in the room. I told her that after her talk, that at that moment, a very short moment, that although we were the only two Asian queers there, I felt a sense of community. My discussion has highlighted the complex, multiplicitous trajectories of queer women's immobilities within and across sites that are mediated by a range of technologies, both new and not so new, dispersed across multiple offline and online contexts, and affectively charged with persistent, agonistic entanglements with the complex politics of recognition, belonging, and a sense of community. Benedict Anderson's classic analysis of the hypostasized identification of nationalism articulates critical links between communication and community in the immensely generative and politically precarious identitarian sphere of imagined community. Communicative practices and artifacts are, in this account, usefully thought of as providing a mediative cultural grammar of an imagined recognition of like subjects in the production of community. In this view, intelligibility and belonging across pluralistic public spaces are cultural accomplishments that are enabled by the technologically mediated semblance of simultaneity, like-mindedness, and social homogeneity. As Aryuna Padurai pithily observes, one man's imagined community is another man's political prison. Imagined community has, since its publication, proven to be a generative and robust construct in contemplating the unavoidable tensions of cultural homogenization and cultural heterogenization produced across the varied mobilities and immobilities of globalization. Political theory critiques of community prove much like critiques of identity, that is to say, they are essential analytical tools circumscribed in their explanatory power by the observation that we are unlikely to abandon our desire for belonging, nor our efforts toward recognition. Cultural studies research on popular culture has prioritized the reframing of engagements by members of subcultural groups with media that are conventionally regarded as debased, non-canonical, insignificant. Henry Jenkins' widely cited work on fan groups emphasizes the cultural significance of participants' mediated practices, as well as the inherent sociality of fandom, which he describes as a participatory culture which transforms the experience of production of media consumption into the production of new texts, indeed of a new culture and a new community. In the research that I've talked about today, participants mediated engagements with diverse queer cultural artifacts and locations provide an important means of mobility between multiple spaces of sociality where the discursive logic of shared interests and intertextuality is concomitantly productive of networked interaction. Having considered the ways in which community and identity are complexly implicated in the production of intimately sutured relations of power knowledge and a politically problematic politics of recognition, how might we think about the affective charge of identifications that exceeds a rational critique of its fallibilities? Hills argues that Anderson's imagined community construct is seemingly affectless, and as such, is mechanistic and incapable of dealing with the affective dimensions of relationality. Drawing on object relations theory to analyze identification and sociality in an online fan community, he posits that, quote, "The community of imagination therefore acts as a specific defense against the possible otherness or even alienness of the inexplicable intensity and emotionality of fandom. Reassuringly, by going online, this intense but somehow almost inarticulate fan experience can be endlessly replicated, and the affect involved can be displaced through a circuit of mimesis, such that the self rebounds against its own unspeakable identifications," end quote. The construal of online sociality as constitutive of a community of imagination offers an important and relevant corrective to any overly deterministic account of practices or technologies of subjectification and affiliation. And it is important here to point out that this is not an idealized articulation of imagination that would be synonymous with something like creativity. In this context, the labor of imagination is dedicated to what Sherry Turkle calls practices of serious play, where identificatory relations provide transitional spaces for the endless work of being and becoming. Virtuality, then, no longer refers to being somewhere else, nor to being online as a location that could somehow be disentangled from offline. A more usefully complex perspective of contemporarily mediated social and cultural geographies conceives of the virtual as a series of contiguous realities marked by perforated boundaries, that is, as ever-proliferating network surfaces that destabilize a monolithic cultural syntax of recognizability. In place of the pleasant foreclosure offered by a finite conclusion, I will pause here and highlight the need for further discussions that trouble perorations extolling the promises of queer virtuality construed unproblematically as utopian incarnation, freedom from the constraints of embodiment, or freewheeling access, either to public space or public knowledge. In an age of digital reproduction, to hearken back to Walter Benjamin's cautionary historiography concerning progress and technology, the work of queer research might be then critically to articulate multiple and complex relationalities between nomadic subjects, counterpublics, heterotopic spaces, and artifacts that are always already problematically lodged within a political economy of consumption and misrecognition. As Foucault noted, "My point is not that everything is bad, but that everything is dangerous, which is not exactly the same as bad. If everything is dangerous, then we always have something to do.